So this session is Religion and the Bible, Modern Science. We're in the right room. Our first speaker today is Lydia Yeager, speaking on the creation of matter in the modern sciences. Lydia has studied physics, theology, and philosophy, and teaches at the Institute du Midi Mondial, just outside of Paris.
Thank you. So there are handouts, and probably not everybody has one, so I have to have at least the opportunity to share one. So I want to explore the relationship between the idea of matter created by God and modern scientific methodology. And you have the points on the handout. So my first introductory point is in fact a brief, very brief introduction to the Greek concept of matter and creation ex nihilo, because not everybody is perhaps familiar with the philosophical background. So the concept of matter was first introduced into philosophy by Ionian physicists who evolved in the 6th century before BC in order to explain physical changes by developing one or more kinds of universal underlying stuff. The concept was then used by Plato and Aristotle and subsequent philosophers in a variety of contexts with a time rather contrasting effect uses. And when the church fathers came into contact with Greek philosophy, they were taking over some of the conceptual tools from Greek philosophy, but they couldn't take over the Greek concept of matter without significant change. In fact, the doctrine of creation ex nihilo led them to confess God as the creator and sustainer of everything, therefore also of matter. And therefore, matter could no longer be seen as it had been, as a source of defect or even of evil. In particular, Christian theologians couldn't represent the creation of the world as the work of the demiurge, who would in fact use pre-existing matter to form the world. And pre-existing matter, therefore the demiurge had no influence on it, and in a certain sense it resisted his action, and therefore was a source of defect. In fact, Christian theologians had to include the doctrine of the creation of matter into their conception of the creation. And just to give you one idea, is going to be a quote from Augustine, who wrestles exactly with this question. And so, you have it on the handout, it's from his Confessions. And there he is commenting on this very issue. The further shapes and diversifies this unshapen matter, there was nothing, neither color, nor figure, nor body, nor spirit. But, this is not my explanation, according to Greek thought, there was something before it. There was, in fact, unformed matter. And then Augustine continues and says this, and yet was there not altogether an absolute nothing, for there was a certain unshapeness without any form. There he just takes over the Greek concept of matter, and then he goes on to say that even this unshaped matter was formed by God. And he looks for biblical inspiration of his idea, and he goes back to the first chapter of Genesis and tries to find it in the Tohu of the second chapter, the second verse of Genesis 1. And then he says this Tohu, I think, refers to the unshapeness of the first matter, which thou createst without form, of which thou wert to make this goodly world. So we can discuss the interpretation of these words that Augustine proposes. I think it's probably difficult to sustain, but the idea is very clear. As God is the creator of everything, he has also created matter. And I would now want to explore three consequences of this changed view of matter for scientific methodology. Very briefly. My first point, in fact, the second from the end of, the creation of matter and the possibility of empirical science. Postulating the creation of matter leads to a very different perspective on the contingency of our world, compared to the conception of a world formed by a demiurge. In the Judeo-Christian view, contingency is not the result of an imperfect formation process, but stems from the free will of the omnipotent creator. The wife of Gilead is in fact only contingent insomuch as he is a bad craftsman. As long as he excels in his art, the finished work matches exactly the telos that he had in mind. And if there is any deviation from the rational essence of things, it results from imperfection. There are two possible sources, either the limitations of the demiurge or the resistance of matter. But in neither case can the work produced by the demiurge be the subject of empirical science. If you take the perfect part of this work, then it will just allow rational exploration, because it's the work of a finite intelligence which has been found matter. And as a result, no experiments are necessary to explore this part of reality. And the other part of reality, so the part which comes from the resistance to the work of the demiurge, allows no science whatsoever. Neither empirical nor rational. For the deviation from the original telos follows no rules, but arises from a principle of irrationality. The creation gives you a very different view. Creation is a free will act of the omnipotent intelligence. And it can thereby be used to undergird the empirical method of modern science, which is in use at least since the 17th century. And because the notion of creation combines the rational work of omnipotent intelligence with free will, and in such a way, contingency is no longer the result of imperfection, but expresses the freedom of the Almighty Creator. And I quote Wolfgang Pannenberg on this: the church value of the notion of contingency consists of the fact that the contingent no longer has its basis in the indeterminacy of matter, but in the freedom of the divine will as the creative foundation of the world and all its parts. We have one other second consequence of the idea of creation of matter for science and history. Not only does the changed perspective that the notion of creation brings to contingency encourage the empirical approach, but the world with its real historical development becomes the subject of scientific inquiry. For the coming into being of the material world is no longer explained by the meeting of form and matter, where only the former is subject to rational laws, but it has its foundation in the historical act of the creator who is supremely rational. And it's very instructive to compare this view with the view set out in Plato's Timaeus. I think it's a very interesting example of how Greek philosophy struggled to integrate history into knowledge. And if you read in the Timaeus, right at the beginning of the myth about the origin of the world, depicted there. So I quote, what is that which is existent always and has no becoming? And what is that which is becoming always and never is existent? So there is no position between reality, what exists, and what is subject to change. Now the one of these is apprehensible by thought with the aid of reason, since it is ever uniformly existent, whereas the other is an object of opinion with the aid of unreasoning sensation, since it becomes and perishes and is never really existent. For Plato then, what is perceptible and changing is not subject of knowledge. Since the intellect can only grasp that which is eternal, a world and its history escapes reason. But the idea of creation has a significantly different perspective on history, as the natural order is by its very essence historical. I won't go on to elaborate the consequence of this, but I think it's very obvious what this means, especially since natural sciences have become so historical, say with biology in the 19th, and biology and geology, and then cosmology in the 20th century. Let me turn to the third consequence, exact science in a material world. The statement that creation is ex nihilo, without any trace of polytheism, there is no independent principle or being which remains, God is the creator of everything. And as such, he has perfect mastery over the world. Nothing can escape his control. Even matter. And if matter is created, it is included under the wise governance of the creator, and this cannot constitute an irrational principle. Matter for the Greek was only understandable in as much as it was informed. But matter created by an orderly and wise God does not put any opposition principle to rational understanding. And therefore, science in the material world becomes possible. A quote, a French philosopher, Jean-Pierre Lizel, writes, "Reality is substantial nourishment for the intellect. Nothing is inert, insignificant, alien, or unable to be assimilated. No matter in the sense of stuff resistant to the intellect, utter waste for the mind." In effect, it's very interesting to see that at the birth of modern science, the debate over the status of matter played a decisive role. In fact, Galileo played it out several times in his imaginary dialogue. And there you find the disagreement between the older scientists influenced by Aristotelian physics and the followers of the new science. And just to give you one example, in his dialogue on the great world systems, Salviati, who is the spokesman for Galileo, insists that mathematical description applies to material objects themselves. And he opposes his view to Simplicio, who is the defender of the old science, the name gives you a hint to which science that Galileo prefers. And so Simplicio says, it is, I quote, "it is the imperfection of matter that makes the matters taken in concrete to disagree with those taken in abstract." And Salviati opposes that and says, I quote again, "what happens in the concrete does in like manner hold true in the abstract." And therefore, concludes Salviati, that mathematical calculations apply perfectly to our material world. And there is a very interesting discussion going on the question if the material sphere touches the material plane in more than one point. And both agree that it doesn't, but the reason given is different. And Simplicio says, it's because the sphere is material. And Salviati answers that and says, no, it's because the sphere is not a real, it's not a perfect sphere. If it was a perfect sphere, it would touch the plane in just one point. And at first sight, when you read this discussion, you get the impression that it's trivial. In explaining why a round object touches a plane surface at more than one point, one side maintains that the material object is an imperfect realization of an ideal immaterial sphere, and the other, says Salvatier, that it's not an exact sphere. But in fact, the two perspectives differ profoundly. And this, in fact, you can see the difference when by the manner they treat the deviation from this very form. For Simplicio, the material imperfection is the end of all possible explanation. You just say the sphere is material, and you can't explain it any further. For Salviati, he seeks an exact mathematical description of how the material object deviates from the ideal form. If the material sphere is not a sphere, it is exactly something else, and this exactly you can describe it. And from whence comes the revolutionary assertion that the book of nature is written in mathematical characters? As I quote a letter from Galileo, "the book of philosophy," which is nature in the context, "stands perpetually open before our eyes, though since it is written in characters different from those of our alphabet, it cannot be read by everyone. And the characters of such a book are triangles, squares, circles, spheres, cones, pyramids, and other mathematical figures, most aptly for such a reading. Mathematics is exactly realized in the material world." And I want to come to a contemporary example, which can show you that this debate is not an old debate, just in Greek philosophy or the church fathers or 17th century philosophy, but I think it can at least in some contexts be a very contemporary issue in philosophy of science. And the example I choose is Nancy Cartwright, the American philosopher of science teaching in London School of Economy. And Nancy Cartwright, in fact, provides us with a very telling contemporary example of the links between the metaphor of scheme, scientific methodology, and the rejection of divine creation as the framework to understand laws of nature. And I unravel this information. In fact, the best known thesis of Nancy Cartwright is, I think, the title of one of her early books, The Laws of Physics 9. In fact, far from being a key concept in the sciences, the laws of nature only supply, in her opinion, an adequate description in a limited, in fact, in a very limited number of situations. Nature, as a whole, resists the universal description. And someone should take into account the fragmentary and partial character of the natural order. And to understand this partial order, she proposes a return to capacities conceptually similar to Aristotelian ages. And she used the metaphor of the devil void. And the devil void, I think, is our void, and it's a void from which universal laws are absent. Of course, Cartwright accepts the amount of order which the sciences currently bring to light, but she refuses to read into this the hint of universal order. And several passages suggest that the devil void is motivated by a separation reminiscent of the distinction between form and matter. In fact, capacities indicate a certain order, but one which is not able to impose itself completely faced with the resistance of real situations, real material situations. Form only partially imposes matter. And thus, Cartwright seeks to establish, and I quote her, the distinction between the tidy and simple mathematical equations of the abstract theory and the intricate and messy descriptions in either word or formula which express our knowledge of what happens in real systems made of real material. And she believes that such a distinction enlightens our experimental practices. I think we cannot move directly from theoretical concepts to experimental design, and I quote you once again, we need to know about real materials and their properties, what the abstract concepts amount to there before we can live anything. But telling us this is no part of theory. That's not the job of physicists, that's the job of engineering. So theoretical concepts only exist in theory. To know what really exists, what is the ground theory and the reflection. The word of ideas, used in Platonic language, has no place for real systems made of real materials, as we write, which is the solution to it. And the privilege which Cartwright gives to, as she says, all things counter, original, spare, strange, results in an attitude which is diametrically opposed to that which is customary in modern science. In her scheme, one feels no productive tension of wanting to extract increasing amounts of natural order from experimental data, which at first glance often seem curving. In current scientific practice, the researcher is of course aware of the approximative nature of any mathematical description of a given situation. The number of factors involved in any real situation is simply too great to allow for a comprehensive description. And the research problem, this research problem brought to maturity, always includes means of separation. In the case where more precision is needed, there is no need to leave the theoretical framework. Rather, a more sophisticated application is developed to take into account the extra complexity. And Cartwright's double void does not make room for this aspect of modern scientific practice. In fact, given the harmony which I have pointed out between the idea of creation and the universality of natural order, this very striving to observe that Cartwright's opposition to law is linked to an atheistic outlook. In fact, it's not totally clear in her writing, and I'll show you where she said it. The first hint, in fact, you get when you read Cartwright is from her very frequent uses of theological metaphors and ideas. She uses God talk to describe laws of nature. And the frequent occurrence of theological metaphors in relation to the laws of nature could lead one to think that this is more than simply a figure of speech. And in fact, the linguistic clue is a good one. Cartwright asserts clearly that the concept of a law of nature necessarily implies a theological context. In fact, I've only found one context, but there it's perfectly clear. It's in an answer to Philip Alport, and there's a discussion going on. Philip Alport rejects what concept of cause because of anthropomorphism. And Cartwright defends a preference for causes over laws, emphasizing the theological weight of the notion of law. And she writes, and I quote her, "I think that in the concept of law there is a little too much of God. We try to finance the issue with possible words, fictive regularities, and secular establishment laws. But in the end, the concept of a law does not make sense without the supposition of a lawgiver." In effect, in private interviews, Cartwright has confirmed the motivation that one might guess lies behind the deduction of capacities. In her view, laws of nature are incomprehensible without God. And later on, she confirmed it also in a conference, which is not published, but the paper is on the internet, a conference in Brera in 2004, where Cartwright publicly defended her thesis that we cannot understand natural law without resorting to God. Of course, she did not conclude from that God exists, but that one must try to take into account modern science without bringing the idea of law into play. And I'm not developing the whole argument because she goes over it. She tries to show that the only account of natural order, which allows for some kind of internal order, which is not imposed from outside, is the notion of Aristotelian nature. So I don't think that's wrong, that even Aristotelian capacities are grounded in God's providence, but nevertheless, this is her line of argument. And she makes it very clear that this is the reason why she rejects laws of nature, because otherwise she can't make use of it or sense of it without believing in God. And her thinking provides us, therefore, with a striking contemporary example of how the rejection of the greater God may favor the reproduction of the Greek concept of matter, and even by doing it, it leads to a significantly different conception of how scientific theorizing applies to a material world. I would say it no longer allows us to understand the process of idealization, which is standard in modern physics. Thank you.
So I have a few minutes for questions. And as far as questions go, let's make a question in the form of an interrogative session for the next piece of that kind of story. Yeah, right here.
I like to, the last sentence of your summary says that Cartwright elaborates the scientific mythology in atheistic setting on the idea that law is atheistic. And I would like to propose that would it be more accurate to say that they're agnostic?
In an atheistic setting. She rejects laws of nature because she thinks that you can't make sense of them in an atheistic worldview. So then she gives a stand-in for laws, which are the Aristotelian natures. So this is a comment on Cartwright's philosophy, and then you can ask if she's right or wrong about it. In fact, I think she's right, to put it very bluntly, that you can't make sense of laws of nature without God who sustains laws of nature. At least then you just think, oh, that's just given. And you don't ask why that exists, or why that intention origin. We're so used to this idea that we no longer see that it's a very striking idea, and that it has taken humanity very long to come up with this idea. In the context of the work of modern science, 16th century, 17th century, very clearly the idea of creation played a major role. Why people believe that there was something that was wrong?
Yes,
over.
You mentioned finally about mathematics, particularly Galileo. And I just wanted to see what you thought about the views of, say, Roger Penrose, who theoretical physicist or finite conditions has a platonic sort of view of the origin of mathematical concepts. Because against the idea of creation ex nihilo, the mathematical concepts really have to kind of precede that. And would you agree that the logical place kind of is the mind of God in terms of your presentation of this?
It's a big question. I think the question would exceed my knowledge. I've never worked on the question of mathematical content the way he is, but he pretended even say in first is standing, so very close to Platonism, that Platonism is the only viable account of why mathematics should work, but so I can't comment on it, I've never worked on this question. Is mathematics in the mind of God? Yeah, I can't give the one sentence answer, but I would just very much. Why I hesitate is that I definitely don't believe in a platonic, so this point is that I don't believe in a platonic realm independent of God. I think that is just goes into polytheism. We can't accept it for a monotheistic view. Why I hesitate is because I think that mathematics is part of the created order. So probably I would go with Descartes, the idea that even mathematical truths are created, and therefore are not in a direct and eternal in God's mind, but in some sense or other one's mind, depends on his creation and therefore his good work. Without being arbitrary, but we get in very deep waters.
Is
this ringing
the bell for you? If so,
please remind me who it is and comment on that right now. I have read the article.
Yeah. Yes, Guillermo Azmé. Yes, it is. It's Guillermo Azmé, exactly. Guillermo Azmé has a book about this. I can't recall the name of the book, by the way.
No, I can't comment on the argument in particular. The only thing that I would say is you should be very cautious when you look into sources, not to conclude from the absence of a theme to the affirmation of the contrary. So I could, but I'm just speculating now. I don't have any precise knowledge on the issue. I could think that perhaps the theme is not in itself affirmed in a very short, in a very strong way. Because, in fact, it's so revolutionary. It's so new. It just doesn't fit into big philosophy. And then, when Christian faith comes into contact with Greek philosophy, you need to rework your concepts. This is why it took so long to get Christology right, Christology Trinity, but you had to wait until the 3rd and 4th century because there were new concepts necessary. It's not that it's not there in the Bible, but you have to elaborate the concept to say it precisely. And I could accept that something like this is going on in the creation of matter, but definitely not the idea that they would not accept God as a plan for everything, which is very clear in the doctrine. But yeah, I don't know more about this.
All right, we're going to have to cut it off there just to move along.